Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, January the 30th. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. There's a big story out of Memphis for those police officers. We'll talk about that. Also, the reaction to the story from some people who simply always want to call everything racism. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Speaker McCarthy, week number three. I think he's off to a great start. We're sending tanks to Ukraine. The documents, that's getting more and more crazy all the time. So let's say hello to our friend Bill Katz in New York. Bill, where I think we have a little bit of the weather that you guys usually get. We're getting a little bit of an icy rain today, Bill.
Oh, well, that's global warming. That's what it is. I mean, there's no question about it. We have an unusually mild winter here, which is also global warming. And next year, when they get a 30 out, what the hell, what is that? next year, when we get a 30-inch snowstorm, they'll call it global warming.
Well, they always do. They always do.
Yes.
Everything is global warming or global cooling or climate change. That's kind of the one that hits all the bases.
That's exactly
climate
right.
Climate change, that's the one that hits all the bases. No, it's just kind of interesting because our two grandsons came over this morning because their mom had a little duty to do, some things she wanted to get done, and kind of left them off, you know, dropped them off over here. But looks like they're going to spend it with us, Bill, because nobody will be able to move their cars in about 3 or 4 hours. So we'll have a little extra company tonight, Bill.
Oh, well, that's it's the new world. It's the new world. Now, wait till electric cars come in completely and dominate the landscape. And I'm thinking, what if electric cars become absolutely mandatory in a state and they have an electrical failure? Where do you get charged? I mean, and and what if there isn't an electrical failure, but there's such an overload that they have to tell people to either stop charging their cars or stop watching MSNBC? I mean, one of the two, just to save electricity. I have a feeling this electric car thing is beginning, the glamour is beginning to fade, and people are realizing it has a lot of problems associated with it.
Right. Well, I think that happened in California, didn't it, a year or so ago, or – they had some power outages, and they had to tell people, either California or some other place, where they had to tell people not to drive their electric cars. But yes, they do have a problem, as I understand, with the rain also. If they get water in the engine, that's also a problem. Now, to be fair, that's also a problem for any automobile. But
yes.
Yeah, I think they need to count to 10 before they do this electric car madness. But I think they are, Bill, because Toyota just said that they're going to take their time doing it. They're not quite ready to jump into the electric car pool. So maybe that'll bring a little sanity into the market. But the prices, Bill, I mean, if nothing else, the prices are pretty much higher than what most people can pay, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. People will have to give up so many other things to buy their electric car, even with the federal tax break. And something they don't want to do. I filled up my car this morning. I hid my face, of course. I always hide my face when I'm at the gas pump because I know I'm committing a sin and I'm ruining the earth. And in fact, I kept it at a certain number of gallons because I didn't want the world to come to an end tomorrow. So I said, okay, 15 gallons, but no more. And I realize it took 2 minutes. Now, what if we go into a world where it takes an hour? And if you don't do it, you don't have any car to drive. I just don't think people are going to go for it. We right. have time, and there are technologies being developed. There are new fuels being developed all the time. The research goes forward. I just wish that they would not hurry into this, understand that there may be alternatives that are better, and also save the taxpayer an enormous fortune in an investment in a car that the taxpayer doesn't want.
Right. No, I think you're right. You're right about that. Well, I have to tell you that I just saw this about an hour ago, and I didn't tell you ahead of time I was going to bring this up, but on this day in 1933, Bill, the Lone Ranger went on the radio. And I have
yep.
I grew up watching the Lone Ranger. My father used to tell me stories about the Lone Ranger on the radio. I've had a chance to go back and listen to some of the Lone Ranger shows. They're absolutely great, Bill.
And that, I believe it was started in Detroit.
I think so.
Yes, that Detroit WJZ in Detroit was a big radio station. Not everything in radio originated in New York or Los Angeles as we have today. That originated in Detroit, and I believe it stayed in Detroit through either most or all of its run. I used to listen to it on the radio. Everybody knew. If you did not know the opening by heart to the Lone Ranger, you were deported. I mean, they came around to your house and they said, "You're not a good American. Get out." You know, and everybody knew it was the Lone Ranger. And the more sophisticated older children, the ones who were nine, the wiser ones, knew that the opening was the William Tell Overture. And we listened. It was, I believe, sponsored by Kellogg's Pep. I believe it was Kellogg's Pep, or was it Ovaltine? I can never remember. There were two big sponsors of kids' adventure shows in the afternoon when I was growing up. One was what they called chocolatey-flavored Ovaltine, and they would have offers, and you would have to send in a label showing you had bought a bottle of Ovaltine. I hated the stuff. It really was. We had jars of Ovaltine in the closet with labels missing just so I could get the offer. But there was that, and there was Kellogg's Pep, and that was another one. And then there was Cheerios, and I cannot remember which one sponsored the Lone Ranger, but those were the big sponsors, and everybody knew them. And you heard the sounds of yesteryear, and the announcer was, oh dear, what was his name? I've forgotten his name offhand, but he had a wonderful, wonderful voice, and he talked about the Lone Ranger being a figure in history, but he pronounced it history, in his story, and he became known for that. It was
well,
Frank
Bill,
Boy.
Didn't you write a Frank post? Boy. Didn't you write a post? Yeah, didn't you write a post about 10 years ago? Didn't you write a post when he passed away? I remember that you wrote a post about him, about this gentleman, who I guess had passed away in the year 2010 or so. And I remember reading a post at Urgent Agenda that you wrote about him. I don't know if you knew him personally or if you had worked with him. But I remember you writing a post about him. If you go to your archives, I think you'll be able to find it.
I probably will find it in the archives. You're talking about the actor who played him.
No, not Jay Servilwheels. That was, not Jay.
That was Tonto.
It was Tonto, right. Whatever the name of the.
Grace
Beamer. I'm talking about the voice. Yeah, I'm talking about the voice of the Lone Ranger that you were just making reference to. I'm pretty sure that you wrote a post about this man. I just remember when you were talking about him right now, remember reading something at Urgent Agenda. Maybe you should, write a post tomorrow saying that if any of your readers remember what I just remembered about the Lone Ranger, that you'll send them a jar of whatever that was, Velveteen or whatever that was that you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, so chocolatey-flavored. Chocolatey-flavored,
yeah.
Ovaltine. Well, yeah. I'm looking up right now on my computer. Brace Beamer died in 1965, so that wouldn't have been him.
Okay.
But there the other one that was famous was Clayton Moore.
That was the actor.
Yes.
That was the actor who played
the Lone
Ranger.
The Lone Ranger never existed.
No, I know. No.
Yeah.
I know, of course. But he was actually a Texas Ranger. That was the original story that we learned after we did some research on the Lone Ranger. He was actually a Texas Ranger, and Tonto saved him after he had been attacked by the bad guys. But does the name Frank Hoy, H-O-Y, does that ring a bell? You wrote something
Frank,
about this.
Frank Foy was the announcer.
Right. Okay, the announcer. That's,
yes.
That's what
and,
I'm talking about.
Frank, let me look up Frank Foy, because Frank Foy, well,
it was a while back, so you may have to look it up a little bit.
I'll have to look it up later because it may not have been Frank Foy. It was somebody Foy, and he was a remarkable announcer, originated some of the cliches that we use in broadcasting today. And the Lone Ranger, it went from radio, of course, in the early 50s or late 40s into television, and it lasted for a certain number of years. It is not a figure today that is known to young people.
No.
Of course, today you can't do it because his Native American associate, Tonto, would not be permitted on the air today.
Right, right. No,
Tonto would have Tonto would have to be the boss.
Well, no, you're right. But I will tell you this. My sons did like the Lone Ranger because I used to tell them about it. So, yeah, they liked him when he came. But anyway, I just remember when you were talking about the voice, I remember you writing something about that. But it was a while back, so it may take you a while for you to find it. And speaking of interesting things, Bill, before we get to the serious stuff, the AP apologized. You wrote a post about this. The AP apologized to the French. What are they apologizing for, Bill?
I have no idea, and neither does anybody else. There have been several articles announcing their apology to the French because they put out a tweet a few days ago regarding their style book. The Associated Press style book is used throughout journalism. What a style book is, it gives you a consistent style for usage of words, when to capitalize somebody's title, but not to capitalize it. And the style book now says it's very woke. It's gotten very woke over the years, not to use terms with the in front of them, like the poor, the downtrodden, and the French. Well, nobody could figure out what was wrong with the term the French. And so apparently many complaints came in. And so the Associated Press issued a second statement saying they were withdrawing objections to the term the French, never telling us why the objection was there in the first place. So that's where we stand today. Kind of tells you something about modern journalism and what they consider important.
Right. No, I couldn't figure it out either. I know you wrote a post about it, but I couldn't figure out what they were apologizing for. You know what?
Yeah, I didn't either.
I keep trying to figure out who got insulted here. Here we go. Just very quickly, I found the post. It was in 2010. Fred Foy, F-O-Y.
Fred Foy.
A man who used to say, a fiery horse with the speed of light.
That's right.
That's
exactly Fred Foy. And Fred Foy was just, you got to know his voice. He became known through the Lone Ranger. All his funny words, ways of saying things like his story instead of history. The reason I remember the name Foy is that the Foys, but I don't think this was his family, were a very famous vaudeville act. But I don't think he was a member of that Foy family, but the name Foy is very familiar in show business. But yes, he was the announcer. And in those days, the announcer of a radio program was big stuff. I mean, to be an announcer was a very, very prestigious thing in radio, because it was the announcer who became often better known through his voice than the people on the program. And there's an interesting story about that CBS regarded the announcer as so important that in those days they had what they call station identification. Every half hour, a radio station would have to identify itself. The reason being that many early radio sets had very poor instrumentation on its tuner, and you think that was the station, and it really wasn't. So at CBS, somebody would go into a booth. It was actually like a phone booth, and they'd say, this is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System, which was its original name, the Columbia Broadcasting System. And Bill Paley, who ran CBS, insisted that the announcers wear tuxedos. Now, nobody saw them, But he said that when you wear a tuxedo, you are reminded that it's a formal occasion and you're going into someone's home and your voice changes. That's very interesting, I think. So they would say this very formally. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. And that interlude became known as saying system. An announcer would say to an associate, oh, I got to go in and say system. And a very important part of radio.
Right. I think that, you know, what the getting, wearing the tuxedo, I think the nuns at the Catholic school must have borrowed that idea because they always wanted us to be well-dressed so that we would always, he said, when you are elegant, when you feel elegant, you are a better person, they used to tell us. So,
yes.
And there's something to that, by the way. I do think there's something to that. I think
that
when you're all dressed up, I think you tend to, you know, I don't know, you maybe behave better. I mean, not always, of course, but that's what they used to tell us, Bill. The brothers and the nuns, that's what they used to tell us.
That's right. And they told us the same thing in our public school. And every week we would have something called assembly. And the entire class would go into the auditorium. And we were all dressed alike. You had to be dressed alike. For boys, it was a white shirt and a red tie. And if you didn't have a white shirt and a red tie, the PTA would give you a set.
Nice.
So I had my white shirt and my red tie, and we went to the assembly. And, yes, it was considered a formal occasion, and you were dressed right and you acted right. And I do think the way you're dressed has something to do with the way you behave. I've never seen anybody in a tuxedo beat anybody up, you know, Now, of course, we didn't wear tuxedos in school, but there was a dress code. The dress code for our school, the dress code for other schools, and the dress codes changed over the years depending on what was in style and also what town you lived in. Some were more formal than others.
Right. Well, here in many of the public schools here in the Texas area, Bill, they have gone back to some kind of a dress code. And that was because the kids were just getting a little bit too sloppy. And they decided that they wanted to have some kind of a dress code. And I don't blame them for that. I think kids look better when they're well-dressed. I mean, I don't care where they are. Well, a lot of stuff to get into today, Bill. The story out of Memphis is so strange. And I was reading something about this today. Obviously, you know, everybody knows about the horrible video and all of that. And obviously, these police officers were out of line. It's a shame because they're hurting the image of the other 99% who don't do stuff like this. But I heard some interesting stories today. Like, for example, why were these five who were members of an elite group, I guess that's what they call them, special elite group, what were they doing stopping somebody for a traffic citation or something? I mean, people were saying, why? Why would these five be doing that? Why aren't they supposed to be going after real criminals? I don't know. It's a crazy story. I don't know if you know any more about it.
It's a very, very crazy story. It's a story that just doesn't add together because, you wonder why five officers, all of them African-American, with body cams that were working and on would engage in this kind of behavior. They know they're being recorded. I mean, what were they thinking? It's baffling to me. I was baffled for the first few days to wonder why nobody was questioning the chief of police about this. There were a couple of interviews with her. She's a African-American woman, like powder puff interviews without any challenging questions about her leadership. After all, she is the leader of the police. And we found out over the weekend that she had been fired from a previous police department for a breach of behavior. Now, that doesn't mean she was guilty of anything here, but she is in charge of the police department. It is her responsibility to see that her people are disciplined and well-behaved. And apparently she didn't do the job. Now maybe they'll ask her some tough questions. But I find it baffling as well. I thought that something would come out indicating that they thought they were in danger, but nothing has come out. They just started once beating this guy, once they had him down, even after he was handcuffed, and I cannot imagine that they consider themselves in any danger. So we'll have to wait for either the trial or some pre-trial disclosures to come to any conclusion, but it certainly looks awful. There's nothing that can justify that. Nothing. They would have to be in mortal danger to justify that kind of beating. And, you know, they've been charged with very grave offenses, second-degree murder, which carries a very heavy amount of jail time. I was watching one legal commentator last night who was knowledgeable, and his advice to the officers under charge would be to plead guilty. Just plead guilty and don't go anywhere near a courtroom. Because if they right. try this in court before a jury, especially a local jury, I can't imagine how it could be good for the officers. Now, they can elect not to have a jury, to have a judge. But even then, it could be difficult. As this lawyer said, just plead guilty and, in effect, throw yourself on the mercy of the court and make sure your lawyers make a good argument. But it's a grim picture, and you wonder how the rest of the police force is trained in Memphis.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story because it's five African-Americans. The victim is African-American. The mayor, the police chief, I assume most of the city council is majority African-American. And yet this happens. And over at CNN, what do? They bring up white supremacy.
Well,
and
of course.
What else could it be, right? Yeah,
well, of course, it must be white supremacy. And what enraged me also, when a commentator on another network said that CNN promoted this story as if it were the Super Bowl. I mean, it was just hype after hype after hype. Their ratings are very, very low, and maybe they thought this was a ratings winner. But yes, Van Jones was on, a man I usually think is pretty moderate, saying, oh, this could be racism, even though the officers were black, because many blacks are conditioned to believe that they're inferior and that other blacks are inferior as well. I don't buy that for a second. There was no racism involved here. This was five officers. I wonder how they got hired. Standards have been dropping for police departments because they can't get police officers. I believe I read that the Memphis Police Department has a $15,000 signing bonus. Well, the question has to be, okay, if you want to have a signing bonus, have a signing bonus, but what are the standards? What kind of people are they hiring? Do they have no idea what these men could do? I mean, didn't anyone observe them in their years on the police force? I doubt very much if an officer just suddenly does this on the spur of the moment. There must have been some warning or something in their backgrounds. We'll have to await further information, but I think there's a much fuller story to be told here.
Yeah. The other thing that I found to be very interesting, Bill, is that, you know, there were some marches and some protests, but certainly not as big as I think they wanted them to be. And so I think overall, most people see this for what it is, five officers who lost control. But I didn't, you know, there weren't any big marches or any big, I guess a couple of places maybe, but in general, did you see anything that was real bad? I didn't. I mean, I thought it was a pretty calm across the country, Bill.
There were some marches in New York that were pretty big, yeah. I think there were a few scuffles with the police. But I think the fact that the officers were black had an effect on the size of the demonstrations. I think had it been five white officers, you would have seen much more passion in the demonstrations.
Oh, yeah.
That's just in the nature of things. But, you know, the left will milk this for as much as they can. I think there is there are many questions to be asked. But what enrages me also is, and I don't take anything away from the grief that the family feels. They are grieving over what apparently was an innocent boy. But every week in America, carloads of black children are murdered. And nobody says a word. Nobody
right.
says a word. How about them? How about some grief for them and their families?
Right.
It seems that the only time a black life really does matter when taken by the police is that when people think they can get something out of it for their own careers. I just find some of the coverage, you know, pitiful in that respect. If black lives are to matter, all black life has to matter.
Right.
And the way in which children are just dismissed, not a good thing.
No, not at all. And there is one face that you always see whenever there's one of these tragedies. It's that lawyer. who seems to be. Yeah, he must. Man, this must be his specialty, because that's every time one of these things happen, he's the guy they retain. I mean, it's just amazing. I don't know if he has any competition, but he's always the one I've seen, though.
He's this generation's Al Sharpton. I mean, in the last generation, anytime an incident occurred, Al Sharpton was there. And anytime a funeral was held, Al Sharpton was the one they called to preside over it. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that it bothers me, because it turns it into an event. It's not an event. It's a tragedy. It's a crime. A boy has been killed. It should be done with, I think, a little bit more solemnity.
Right.
Trump is not a man I particularly like. He made a couple of statements last week before this whole thing occurred in Memphis about the governor of Florida, in which he got every fact wrong. And I think he's very much a careerist. Okay, he can be a careerist and an expert in this area. I have no problem with that. But what I don't like is what amounts to the commercialization of a tragedy like this.
Right. Well, that's what happens. They become it's a big business. I mean, you know, they're going to win. They're probably going to sue the city of Memphis for a lot of change. And,
oh, yeah.
It's going to be in the millions. I'm not saying they shouldn't sue them, but it's going to be in the millions. But, you know, Tennessee has a pretty conservative, in fact, a pretty good conservative Republican governor, who some people talk even presidential material. I can't think of the fellow's name right now. I think it's Lee, the last name. Maybe they should take over this police department, because it looks to me like this is a police department that needs they don't need to send these men to any training sessions. I they don't need any training. What they need is something else. They need some discipline. And this reminds me of a story, Bill. Whenever I see these incidents, I always think of lack of discipline, because that's really what it is. You have five men doing this, and apparently there was another one too, a sixth man who has also been suspended. So you have five men, veterans, and there's not a single one who says, hey, let's stop this. We got to stop this. You know, that's the thing. Not one stops it or says, no, we can't do this. We can't do this. And it reminds me of a story. You remember that great historian Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E, Stephen Ambrose.
Stephen Ambrose, yes.
Yes, who wrote books about Eisenhower and World War II and all that. And he was on a show one time, and he was saying that he was talking about the American soldier. And he was saying that whenever the American soldier showed up in any place, any European place, anywhere, that the citizens felt a lot more comfortable with them than the soldiers of other countries. And
yes,
the reason is that the discipline of the American soldier, the fact that there was a discipline, there was a commanding officer who was disciplining these and kept these men in line. I'm not saying that in every case it was perfect, but for the most part, it was. And that's what I didn't see in Memphis. I didn't see that kind of discipline that would have stopped something like this, you know, where one guy stands up and says, no, you got to cut this out. This is not what we do. That's what I didn't see. And that worries me about the whole department, Bill.
Well, that's exactly right. It was I mentioned the Fox reporter before, who commented on this, an African-American gentleman, and he knows a great deal about the police, and he was looking at the tape right from the start, from before the beating began, and he said, if you look at the way these officers were behaving, even as they approached the victim, approached the suspect, who later became a victim, it was so unprofessional. He said, if you're going to approach a car with a man in it who you're looking to either arrest or question, you don't just run up to it on the side. There are procedures they follow to protect the officer, and they didn't follow any of them. They said they didn't even protect themselves, that this was just so amateurish. So that's going to go to training, and it's going to go also to reporting and the way in which the chain of command operates within the police department. In terms of taking over the department, that is usually a federal function. There have been several departments in the past that have been not taken over but disciplined by the Department of Justice. I think they have a special office for it, and I think that the Department of Justice can hand down, or perhaps through a court, get a court order that the department must do certain things, and then it's monitored by the Department of Justice. I'm not sure of the entire procedure, but there have been a number of federal cases.
Right. No, no, something's got to be done, because that was obviously a very bad situation. We're going to take a little break, Bill. We'll be right back. We'll talk a little bit more. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. As always, the music of my good friend Carlos Geddes. I have a link on the show information to his website. We're chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We were just talking about those police officers in Memphis. Bill, let's move on to another topic here, which I wanted to touch on, and that's Speaker McCarthy. I think he's off to a great start, Bill. He's in week number three, and I saw him yesterday on Face the Nation, and I said, you know, when he was fighting back, not fighting back, but he was talking back to the moderator of that program, the lady Margaret, I can't think of her name.
Margaret Brennan.
Yeah, Margaret Brennan, and she was asking him some questions, you know, how can you put all these deniers on these committees? And I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, well, did you ask the Democrats that same question? When they put a bunch of deniers in their committees, I thought that was a great deal. I'm glad to see that.
Great
I'm
answer.
Glad to see that they're fighting back.
Yeah, absolutely. And she, well, she's particularly bad. I mean, she's so obviously on one side, and that was a good answer.
Well, yes, it was. And I didn't realize that she was that one-sided because I honestly don't watch that show. I used to watch that show. At one time, there was a fellow named Schieffer who used to do that show.
Bob Schieffer.
Face the Nation. Yeah, I thought he was better, honestly.
He was, Well, the whole news operation there has deteriorated. I mean, it's now not, CBS News is not what it was when I was a kid.
No, but I thought that, you know, this. I didn't have much reference as far as this lady, Margaret Brennan, but I thought the speaker came back well. I guess this is the week they're going to start doing some hearings, and they need to do hearings, Bill, and not just on these documents, but at the FBI. The information on Twitter keeps coming out every single day. More and more stuff keeps coming out. We got to know exactly what was going on, and none of it sounds good to me, Bill.
No, there's a lot that's going to come out. This is going to be a season of investigations, and I think that because it's now a Republican House, they're going to concentrate on Joe Biden. I don't know how much cooperation they're going to get out of federal agencies, which are still under Democratic control, but I think the people in the Republican Party who are conducting the investigations are thorough workers, good workers. I think they're interested in getting to the facts, and so am I. I think in certain respects, this is a much more serious situation than the Trump papers. Trump may have kept some classified information. It was probably just sloppiness, although it could be more serious, and we have to leave that possibility open. But in Biden's case, it was pointed out that he has a family business, in effect. I mean, his family members are involved in trading with foreign countries, obviously. His name, associated with his name, gives them a certain amount of clout. Some of the papers were found in the home occupied by Hunter Biden during this period. I think there could be some things there, but again, this is speculation that could be embarrassing and possibly more than embarrassing. I think a thorough investigation might turn it up, but remember, federal agencies can grab those papers. They're not in possession of the committee yet, and we know what federal agencies can do, so we have to just wait and see.
That's right. Now, one thing, I think his biggest problem is explaining what he was doing with papers when he was a senator.
Yes.
That is the problem that I see, because, you know, the VP and the president papers. Obama could say, I had declassified those papers.
Yes.
So I thought I had, and kind of, you know, throw a lifesaver there to Joe Biden. But he can't do that on the Senate papers. That is really a bad deal. How he had papers from the Senate. That is, I don't know how you do that, Bill, because every interview that I've seen, including one not long ago here with our Senator Cornyn from Texas, he was saying, yes, we see those papers as a senator, but we go into a room, we see them, and then we leave them in the room. So how did he get them? That's a real question that I have, though.
Yes, and how did he get him out of that room? That's,
yes.
You know, I worked in a federal agency once, and we had very highly classified information, and the rules were strict. And one of the rules was you didn't take classified material home. That was an absolute rule. You just did not take it out of the agency. And this is, look, these are baffling stories. I can understand how a president might do this. He lives in the White House. The papers are there. His quarters are there. He might have brought some things upstairs to read. But it still shouldn't have happened. But a senator, I don't know. The standards are supposed to be much higher. And I do think that if there was material there that is classified and pertained in any way to Hunter Biden's business affairs in another country, there could be some considerable repercussion.
Yeah. You kind of get the feeling sometimes, Bill, that that Joe Biden was a little bit just kind of – he wasn't on top of things. You kind of get that feeling. And that he kind of, you know, he didn't want to do, I know his son had gone through some addiction problems and all of that. And maybe he wanted to help his son too much. But you kind of get the feeling that, you know, just looking at it as a father, that the son here was really abusing his father or taking advantage of his father. I mean, I know that has not been proven in the courtroom, but that's the impression I have. That the father was being a little lackadaisical here, and the son was just taking advantage of everything that he could, Bill. That's the impression I get. I'm not saying that's illegal, but that's the impression I get, Bill.
Well, I think a lot of people have that impression. And again, this is subject to the investigation. We'll have to see how the investigators do it, and also then how it is reported. There is that's always the 1,000-pound gorilla in the room is the press. You can have a perfectly valid story and have the story twisted around by the press. Remember, the press is for the most part is on Joe Biden's side. We have a left-tilting press, so we'll have to see how what kind of information we get and how zealous the press is in getting that information. They may not be very zealous at all.
Well, they haven't been. They have not been. I mean, I think he's had really a pretty easy ride from the press, certainly on the border. I mean, that story has not gotten the attention that I think it should have gotten. And now we hear that the northern border, Bill, up in Canada, that people are coming in record numbers. I guess that's what happens when you don't have a border. You know, if you don't have a border in the south, you don't have one in the north either, Bill.
Well, you know, the border on the south is such a disgrace. The fact that we've handled it so badly gives bad guys the impression that all our borders are handled badly, and they will try to exploit it. And it's a terrible thing that is happening. People don't realize how serious borders are. Borders aren't just lines in the sand. They represent our sovereignty. They represent our laws. They represent safety for Americans when the borders are maintained. It's a serious subject not being taken seriously enough. I mean, we have a situation now where people are pouring across the southern border. They are not here legally. They are being sent to cities like New York. Right here in New York City, we have a situation where several hotels, luxury hotels to be sure, in the theater district, which is the heart of what New York City is about, have been taken over by these illegal migrants. The places are a shambles. Food is thrown out the window. They don't like the food. The city of New York is not getting the help from the federal government that it deserves in absorbing these people, getting them some income. The cost is ghastly, while legitimate New Yorkers are not being protected. This is, I don't know why it has not yet hit as hard as it has, as hard as it should, but this is a disaster for the United States.
Well, it's not much better for New York. Excuse me for a second. I was just coughing.
That's quite all right.
No, but what I was saying is that, you know, I'm looking at a headline right now, like you're talking about these immigrants who refuse to leave a hotel, and you have to ask yourself, who's telling these people, who's advising these people? Because, I mean, they have to know they're in the country, they're guests in the country. You know, I mean, the whole idea, I think most good immigrants would have been grateful to the city of New York for putting them up in a hotel. You know, most people wouldn't be complaining like this, throwing food out. So who's giving these people advice? Who's telling them? It just puzzles me. We're seeing things, Bill, that are so strange that you couldn't even dream them up. If you made a movie with a script like this, the director would throw it back at you and say, I don't believe any of this. Go rewrite it. I mean,
yes.
It's crazy what we're seeing, Bill. The northern border is open. The southern border is open. Now you have this story out of New York. I saw something in the last hour. I was watching the news out of Chicago. You've got citizens complaining to the local government. You know, we can't afford these people. Why are we using resources for these people? So it's like, you know, stuff. There are things happening, Bill, that I wouldn't have believed. If anybody had said this to me 5 years ago, I would have said, come on, that's never going to happen, Bill.
Well, what has happened is that the Democratic Party, which has national power through the presidency and local power through the left-wing mayors of Democratic cities and left-wing district attorneys financed by George Soros, who's a left-wing financier, are now very much in charge of the system, and they are doing as much destruction as they can. I you know, it's hard to say, but you look at these situations and you wonder if some of these mayors and some of these district attorneys and some of the people in the Biden administration below the presidential level have any respect for their country at all. And the answer, I'm afraid, sometimes has to be no.
Right. But I think what we're also seeing, Bill, is that there's no political consequence for doing this. In other
that's
words,
right.
If you're Mayor Adams, is there going to be a Republican opposition that's going to bring this up? Maybe they'll bring it up, but they're not going to defeat you. So many of these politicians, whether it's the mayor of Chicago, the mayor of Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, and so on, they're immune from really how bad they're governing because there is no opposition, and they're going to get reelected over and over and over again. So there's really no political cost to any of this. I mean, you would think that if there was any kind of opposition in New York, that just this issue alone of the hotels would destroy a local politician, Bill.
Well, that's certainly true. And we had a mayor in New York, de Blasio, who's one of the worst mayors we've ever had, who got reelected because New York is zombie land. I mean, they go to the polls and they just press that Democratic lever. They don't seem to care anything about what happens. And these are not, by the way, a bunch of voters in some area of New York where nobody went past the sixth grade. These are voters in parts of Manhattan where people normally have at least a college degree, but they are hardened liberals and they will only vote for the Democratic Party. Now, there is one city in which there do seem to be some political repercussions, and that's Chicago. There's a Chicago mayoralty race. I believe that the election is actually going to be next month in February. I don't know if that's the final round. I don't know how they vote in Chicago with all these new fancy voting techniques. But the current mayor is in the running for reelection, and she is way behind. And the assumption is she will not be reelected. So that's one small step for Chicago. I don't know who the competition is, though. The competition could be worse. But
right.
But
well, it's going to be a Democrat.
She,
you know that. I mean, she'll be replaced by another Democrat, right?
Oh, sure. And here in New York, we have elected Republican mayors. We elected Giuliani. We elected Mike Bloomberg when he was a Republican. Well, he switched parties a couple of times, so he was really an independent. But you can elect a mayor who isn't a Democrat if you get to it, get to the campaign, get a good candidate out there, and get behind him or her. And the Republican Party basically gives up on New York City campaign before the campaign even starts.
Right.
You know, that's been the attitude. The only reason Giuliani won in the 1990s was because he had such a dynamic personality, he basically ran his own campaign. I don't think he depended on the Republican Party. It's a four-year term for mayor. So Adams has a long way to go. I think he means well. I think he's superior to the last mayor. He has no real power. The power really is with the state legislature and with the governor, who has shown no inclination at all to do anything about the crime problem.
Right. No, you're right. You're right about that. Well, a couple of other stories, Bill. One very quickly, you know, when the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade and sent it back to the states, we knew there would be states doing different things. And in Minnesota, they have just approved a pretty liberal abortion law, which basically allows abortion, I guess, till the last day of the pregnancy. You know, I knew that stuff like that was going to happen, but it's still, to me, horrific to think how anybody could vote for something or an abortion law like that, Bill. I can understand, you know, the 15 weeks or 12 weeks, some kind of a restriction. I can understand that. And I'm willing to compromise like that. But when you say to me an abortion in the entire pregnancy, how can anybody even do that, Bill? It's just something I don't know how in the world. I don't know whether they think about these things or whether they're under such political pressure that they have to vote that way. But it's mind-boggling. I couldn't sleep with myself if I had voted for a law that says that you can abort a baby at any point in the pregnancy, Bill.
Well, this is pure radical feminism. And it's the radical feminist movement that is behind this free abortion on demand at any point, our bodies, ourselves, all that other stuff. And they are in charge of parts of the Democratic Party. There's no question about it. I mean, you see on a number of issues, positions taken that are very radical, that are out of line with what most Americans think, and they don't care. They are interested only in their power. And as far as the baby is concerned, they do not recognize that baby at all. They don't recognize that baby as being of terribly great importance. Only the woman is important, and they don't believe in any restrictions. That is not the way most Americans feel. Every poll shows that. They just don't care. They are a party now controlled completely by ideology. Whatever the ideology of the moment is, and what the heads of the organization or the movement say, that's it. That's it.
No, you're right. You're right about that, and this is a good example of it. One last story, Bill, I wanted to ask you about tanks going to Ukraine. You know, I'm not that upset about that because I personally think that we should be helping Ukraine, but I'm not real comfortable with our leadership, but I think as far as Ukraine is concerned, they seem to be doing the right thing. Do you agree with me on that?
Yes. Excuse me. I think we have to help Ukraine. The problem is that we're becoming more and more committed without any end in sight. I think the critics of our policy have a point when they say, what is our objective? How do we meet it? And when do we get out? And I think having been burned a couple of times by long wars, they have asked some good questions. We should be trying to force both sides into some kind of compromise. I don't know how you do it. I'm not an expert in that. But I think Americans fear that it's going to be month after month, billions and billions of dollars. The Europeans, as usual, are not pulling their load or their part of the load. And so it's mostly the United States, and I think there is a deep fear that eventually we will have some kind of military forces involved, which would be terrible, just terrible, just another, you know, meat grinder that will go on and on. I think that we have to, now that we're committed in a way to Ukraine, we can't let them die, because that will just destroy our foreign policy. Although he did that, Biden did that in Afghanistan, and he seemed to get away with it. But we have to basically say to Ukraine, look, we'll give you a certain amount of help, but you and the Russians must negotiate an end to this. And that may have to be done through sanctions on Russia, greater sanctions, greater pressure on Russia. I think that Ukraine would feel an obligation to get involved in negotiation. I don't think after all the help they've been given that they can turn us down, but I can understand what the critics feel, that this is an aimless war, that there is no real strategy.
Right. No, I was going to say, I hear what you're saying, because I sometimes feel that way. I'm torn between wanting to help Ukraine, but do it the right way. And that's where
yes.
I am, you know, trying to make sure that it works out. Another concern, Bill, that we've heard is we're running out of ammunition. That,
yes,
you know,
we are.
We may not be able to fight a war with China or even expand our war in Ukraine. I mean, we're kind of running out of ammunition, and that's a little scary, Bill, because we've had that happen before, and it didn't end well.
That's exactly right. We are now paying the price for letting our forces run down, and our warehouse is not exactly as full as it should be. And apparently some of the equipment that we are giving to Ukraine to be used is very sophisticated equipment. We don't have that much of it, and getting the supply lines and the production lines started again is a rather complicated affair. I think this is something Congress must investigate immediately.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think it was the same general who said that, or former general who said that, who also sent a message to the British telling the British, you guys are not ready for a war either. You guys have really cut back on your military, and you're, you know, you don't have the ammunition either. I thought that was an interesting comment that he made.
Yes.
So Bill, as always, go ahead. I'm sorry. I wanted to go ahead and finish. Yeah, please.
I think it was a good comment on Britain. They are skimping on defense again, and this is a conservative government.
And they were supposed to be the best ally in terms of military. I mean, if the British don't have the resources, who else? Because the rest of the NATO group, as you know, has never been very good at keeping their defenses in good shape. Well, Bill, thank you so much. I hope that all this ice in our city did not impact too much our communication today, but we are getting a little bit of ice out there, a little bit of icy rain, and sometimes it gets on the cables and it affects the line. So I hope it wasn't too much of a problem today, but I do want to thank you as always.
No, my pleasure. Al Gore will take care of you on the ice thing.
Well, that's what
he'll
I thought.
Care.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you could send him down here, because you keep seeing him as a sandwich man, right? In
yes,
New
that's
York.
Right, the sandwich boards. Yes.
So I thought maybe you could send them our way for a few days, because we could use his help. But have a wonderful day, Bill. As always, thank you for your time, and thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to our next time.
I look forward to it too, Silvio.
Good night, Bill.
Good night.
Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. And I hope everybody who lives in North Texas doesn't get too rounded up in this rain. Talk to you later, everybody.